The following program is a Zygon International audio presentation.
Welcome to New Dimensions. This is your host, Michael Toms, for this edition of New Dimensions, and it's a great pleasure for me to say that our guest for this edition is Joseph Campbell. Joseph, it's nice to have you with us.
I'm delighted to be back, Michael.
For those of you who may not be familiar with Joseph Campbell's work, although I find that hard to imagine, Joseph is one of the more renowned mythologists of our time. He's authored such books as The Mythic Image, Hero with a Thousand Faces, The Masks of God, The Portable Jung, and so many other books. He's been a large force in the popularization of mythology and the understanding that we have of our roots and where we go back to over the centuries. And I think perhaps a good way to begin, Joseph, would just be to ask you what you've been doing over the last couple of years since the last time we talked with you here on New Dimensions.
Well, since I retired from teaching, I've been lecturing largely and working on a new book, a big book for McGraw-Hill. It's going to be loaded with pictures. It's simply marvelous to work for a publisher who asks for more pictures instead of getting very nervous when you suggest an illustrated volume. And this is going to be a pictorial atlas of world mythology, a review in a very concise form, actually, although it's going to be a 450-page, two-volume work of the long story of man's imaging and envisioning of the potentialities of his own spiritual life.
Why is it important? Why is it important for us to understand our past?
Well, because somebody said if you don't learn from history, you'll do it again, you know. But more than that, there are certain constant motifs that continually recur and that can be recognized as a basic line of human spiritual need, potential, and manner of fulfillment. And the distractions of the excitements of the various moments of history may pull us away from that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's through these that one can, as it were, find one's direct center line again. Plato, I think it's in the Symposium probably, or rather the Timaeus, actually, I recall now, he says that there's only one thing that one man can do for another, and that is reintroduce him to those constant forms which at birth we lose track of because of the distractions of the senses. Now this is to say that this is not to say that we must not be distracted by the senses. It's too rich a world, and there'd be no history if we were not moving in different styles in different times. But it's a steadying thing to have this other line. And I've found that the way to become really familiar with these lines is by a comparative method, not remaining fixed in one mythological tradition, our own, for example, or to get excited about one other and get stuck with that, but to make a comparison back and forth. And it amounts really to finding the spiritual norm of the human race. If you were to think of humanity only in terms of the structure of one or another of the various races of man, you would not have the whole picture. And so it is when we become fixed to one mythological tradition, which until relatively recently was the way things went. You read the old story of ancient, medieval, and modern. This is just one line. How many history books do that, you know? And then the bizarre thing off there somewhere in the east of the great civilizations of India and China and Japan and the Muslim world, or then the non-literate societies. These are all clues to basic human structuring functions.
You know, in today's world, especially when you read the newspapers or listen to the news or watch it on television, there isn't very much discussion or hardly at all of the spiritual ideals or the spiritual base of many of other cultures and other countries, other nations. And when you mention something like the spiritual norm of the human race, it brings to mind that there is a spiritual base in other cultures and other countries and other nations that doesn't get paid attention to very much by the political establishment. How do you see that as important related to what's going on in the world, particularly politically?
Well, in politics and economics, the mode, and inevitably, is conflict. Politics is winning over somebody else. And economics is, again, winning over somebody else. And I think it's a good thing to have fight, you know, and to be in the world struggle. That's what life is. But it's in the spiritual realm that there are these constants. It's a shame that typically there has been a fight in the spiritual realm also, namely our religion is the true one and these other people are pagans or infidels or whatnot. And you get the political accent there as well. But in this comparative approach that I've been speaking of, one recognizes the constants and that you are in counterplay in your political and economic life with one of your own kind, not something alien. And you can regard the person as a thou, you know, as you would in a tennis game, the person on the other side of the net. It's not as though you were fighting a monster. And the old political style is to turn the man on the other side of the net into a monster. Every war we've done that, you know. But to know that this is a thou as well, a human being with the same sentiments and potentialities as yourself, at least civilizes the game. And then in other relationships, social and otherwise, there's a possibility of a real sense of accord and commonality, which I think is very, very important. In this world, I think the airplane since World War II, which has brought the whole planet into just one travel field, you might say, in 2 days you can be anywhere on the map. And we've got among us, consequently, people such as when I was a young man, one never even saw. People from parts of the world that were just fabulous, distant places for romance. Here they are, and meeting them in a deep way, not a sentimental way, becoming united with them, I think, is of tremendous importance today. Because the thing that's before us is the problem of what is our social group. Our social group is mankind now. Formerly, it was this group, that, and the other. And always in the older traditions, love was for the in-group, you know, and aggression and all that outward. Now there is no out-group, so what are we going to do with the aggression? It has to be civilized.
Do you think politics can catch up?
Well, everything is done in the opposite direction, I would say. I don't know what politics can do. I think it's fair to say that I'm a little bit discouraged by the people who are involved in the political life of this country. There's been not just the Watergate, but many, many other signs of really indecent behavior. I begin to feel that the country has been betrayed, that its potentialities have been sold down a river for values that are inscrutable to me. I don't know what the devil these people are fighting for.
Certainly one of the situations we have in our current life is the aspect of technology and how important technology is. And I know that you've dealt in your writings and in your lectures with the ancient conflict between science and religion. And you have stated that that's really a conflict between 4000 BC and 2000 AD, two sciences fighting, one older than the other.
Yes.
I'm wondering how you see that now, is it relative to that battle between religion and science. Do you see it coming together? Do you see a synthesis happening?
Well, my basic position is that as a result of the fact that our tradition has been rendered in scripture, you know, and all of our institutional religions are based on this scripture. And the scripture dates from 2,000 or more years ago, that we have become fixed to a view of the world that is out of accord with what we now are experiencing in the way of the world. When you consider that 1543, when Copernicus published his heliocentric system, this could not be assimilated by the religious teachers of the time. The story of Galileo's trial is well known, and that wasn't the only one. And then when Darwin brings out in the middle of the 19th century what was already a rather old theory, Goethe has it and others, of the evolution of life, it was contrary to the idea of fixed species, and again, this thing. Well, the science that has been held against modern science is an archaic one. The science, as you say, of about 2000 BC against that of 2000 AD. But the religious mood, the mood of the recognition of the mystery of the universe that lies behind all these images, any image can become a icon, a revelation of this dimension which is transcendent of the science and yet informs it. And it seems to me it's the work of poets, artists, to bring that out, to know what the world image of today is, and to render it as the old seers did and the old prophets, render it as a manifestation of this transcendent principle. That's what we lack today, really. I think poets and artists who really speak of the mystery. There's been so much social criticism in our arts, you know, and satire and all of that, which is just one degree, even this side of the positivism of science, that the other function of the poet of opening the mystery dimension has been, except for certain really great exceptions, forgotten. I think that what we lack really isn't science, but poets and people to reveal to the heart what the heart is ready to recognize, namely this mystery.
Are there characteristics of a culture or a civilization that honors its artists, that honors its poets? We don't seem to do that very much in our culture.
Well, it's the worst here in the United States. When you go to France, there are streets named after their poets. We have them named after generals and things like that. This is a curious thing about our country. When you think of Melville, Mark Twain, and Emerson, and go to the places where those men lived, there's no recognition of their having been there in street names or place names or anything of the kind. You've got the mayor of the city, perhaps, on five or six different street corners, but not the poets and artists.
What does that reflect?
It reflects, I think, a businessman's mentality. That's what's running and has run and has made this country. It's a curiously unartistic country in its common character, and yet it has produced some of the really greatest artists of the century. And they're not recognized publicly. Those that are recognized publicly are the razzle-dazzlers that come across in the public, popular media, you
like
know.
Hollywood.
Yeah, that sort of thing. People fatuously falling on their faces before some marvelous movie actor or something like that. But the poet, the artist, and it isn't as though we didn't have poets and artists. I think, for instance, in California, Robinson Jeffers is one of the really great poets of the century. And when I mention him, and I frequently do, because particularly that Roan Stallion to me was a revelation, people don't even know his name. But when they read the lines that I cite, they recognize a poet. It's curious.
Yeah, we have no support mechanisms to allow artists and poets to really even survive in our culture.
Well, the real support mechanism would be the popular mass media. And they're not interested.
Yeah. Because, again, of the commercial orientation.
I don't know what it is. Yeah. I don't understand those people. The things that they're interested in purveying to the public, I'm not saying that they're not worthy, but why is it all running in the same direction, you know, something of a momentary, sensational interest.
Yeah. And of course, you feel that it's very important that art and poetry and music be a vital part of any culture, any civilization.
It is what is vital. The rest isn't.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And you can see it in people's lives, people who are concerned with simply, you know, making money and then having fun. They're not having fun, basically. They're not having fun making the money. It's exciting, but they're not having deep satisfaction out of it. But some are. There are some people who are really great money makers. But people who, whom I know in the main are not having fun. And then when they get the money, then they go on a holiday, and it's a silly holiday very often.
Yeah.
And it's too bad, because today there are so many marvelous things one can do with a little bit of money. They travel, and I've been on a number of marvelous tours in recent months. The University of California conducted two, and then an organization in New York and so forth. And I see that it's easy to travel, it's pleasant to travel, and the facilities for introducing you to the history of the place you're in are really developed. In Greece, for example, they actually have a school for training their guides, and their guides are marvelous. And then I was in Egypt, the same thing. We had an archaeologist as our guide there. And this is a world that opens up the spirit. Egypt to me was a knockout. I read a great deal about it and all of that. But to be there and to see this tiny little stream with a little bit of green on either side and the rest of it sand, you know, which for 6,000 years has been a culture center. It's a thrilling experience.
Joseph, in a book entitled Myths to Live By, he wrote, "What we all today surely recognize is that we're entering one way or another a new age requiring a new wisdom. Such a wisdom, furthermore, as belongs rather to experienced old age than to poetically fantasizing youth, and which every one of us, whether young or old, has now somehow to assimilate. Moreover, when we turn our thoughts to religion, the first and most obvious fact is that every one of the great traditions is today in profound disorder. What have been taught as their basic truths seem no longer to hold." End of quote. And I also want to quote a recent Gallup survey, I think, which showed that there was a turning away from institutionalized religion, and yet there is a tremendous upsurge in the search for the ultimate. Could you go into that in a little more depth?
There's an analogy to the Penn situation in the history of our American Indians in the 19th century. The 70s and 80s of the last century, the buffalo were wiped out, so that the wheat fields of the advancing white man could go out into what had formerly been the buffalo country, and so that the iron horse, the railroad train, wouldn't be interrupted by millions of buffalo, and also so that the food supply of the Indians would be removed and they'd have to go into the reservations and accept the handouts of the United States government. As a result of that, the essential social religion, social cult, which was centered on the buffalo. The buffalo was the animal master and was the principal sacrificial victim, the animal that was the food supply, killed, returned to the earth in ceremonies so that it could return again. This animal was gone, and the old religion of the buffalo was gone. And that wonderful book of Black Elk Speaks, I mean, part of his vision was the end of the buffalo age and the coming of the tree, you might say, the agricultural time. It was when the social religion dissolved that way and the object of the cult disappeared that the peyote cult came up from Mexico and overwhelmed the plains cultures with the outer object of vision and religious contemplation removed. The inward search began. I think something like that's what has happened here. In the 60s, there was a fundamental disillusionment about the political life in the United States. Also, a disintegration of the religious position. Look what happened to the Catholic Church, you know, with Vatican II, with the turnover there and the unsettling. The turn inward comes along. And I think it's that inward search that is dominant today. I noticed that I've been receiving advertisements for a series of books being published by the Paulist Press. Now, that's a Roman Catholic press. A series of books on Western mystics and translations of mystics whom you couldn't find in bookstores. That the accent had been on the institutional religion, and now comes up what might be called the Pentecostal or inward experiential side. People like Dionysius the Areopagite and Meister Eckhart and John of the Cross. Try to find those in your popular libraries. Now they're going to be published. And the advertisement said that the 60s was for Oriental mysticism and the 70s is going to be for the Western. Well, here's an influence now being accepted by an institution that traditionally has been a little bit disturbed about the mystical, because there one comes in touch with the mysteries alone, you know, on one's own, inwardly, whereas the institution has been officially the one purveyor of the grace of the mm-hmm. divine right. salvation. It's another kind of religion.
There's a difference between dogma and...
and the experience.
Yes.
And all this thing about the mysticism of track, you know, running, and the rapture and ecstasy in sexual experience and all, these are all mystical. These are all related to the loss of ego, tenacity, do you see, yielding to a larger breaking open, as it were. That's what mysticism is, and these are the foregrounds, these are the shallows of that depth.
What about the desire on the part of literally hundreds of thousands, even millions, to pursue a master teacher, a guru? Is that something that's gone on over the centuries?
Yes, and I think that is bad news. I really do. There's one quotation I ran into in a medieval text, the Quest del Saint Graal, which I have frequently quoted in my lectures, and I don't know whether I've ever published it in a book. I think not. But I ran into it some years ago, and it just hit me like a bullet as being the essence of what I would call the European or Western spirituality. The knights of King Arthur's court were seated at table, and Arthur would not let the meal be served until an adventure had occurred. And indeed an adventure did occur. The Grail itself appeared, carried by angelic miracle, and covered, however, with a cloth. And everyone was in rapture and amazement, and then it withdrew. And then Arthur's nephew, Gawain, stood up and said, "I propose a vow. I propose that we should all go in pursuit of this grail to behold it unveiled." And it was determined that that is what they would do. And then occurred these lines that seemed to me so wonderful. They thought it would be a disgrace to go forth in a group. Each entered the forest at the point that he had chosen. He had chosen, where there was no path and where it was darkest. Where it was darkest, then there was no way or path. Now, if there's a way or path, it's someone else's way. And the guru has a path for you. He knows where you are on it. He knows where he is on it, namely way ahead. And all you can do is get to be as great as he is along that way, which he knows. This is a continuation of the dependency situation of childhood. Maturity consists in outgrowing that and becoming one's own authority for one's life. And what seems so romantic in the West to Oriental people, this quest for the unknown, what is unknown is the fulfillment of your own unique life, the like of which has never existed on the earth. And you're the only one can do it. People can give you clues, you know, how to fall down and how to stand up, but when to fall and when to stand and when you are falling and when you are standing, this only you can know. And to do it in the way of your own talents is the only way to do it. Now, if one goes out for athletics, that the coach doesn't tell you exactly how to hold your arms. He watches you run and sees how it is and then tunes you up a little bit. It's your way, and that's the way of the whole life, it seems to me. This is why I don't think the guru thing is as great as it's supposed to be. It's an Oriental idea where the uniqueness of the individual is utterly disregarded. I think I'm right there. I've spent a long time with Oriental studies. I see nothing that does not say each has the law of his caste or his tradition or his church or whatnot to follow. There's never any indication that you've got it right in yourself and that no one knows. Yeats, in A Vision, speaks of the two masks, as he calls it, that a life wears. The first is the primary mask that the society has put upon you, the technique of life that the society puts on you. But at adolescence, the individual has a sense of a potentiality within himself that has to throw off that mask and find what Yeats calls the antithetical mask, the mask contrary to that of the society. And then comes that struggle so characteristic of youth in our society. In a traditional society, you're not allowed to follow the antithetical. The primary is there like a cookie mold on you. But here comes this struggle. Now, if the family or society opposes that, it becomes rather fierce. But a yielding, a gradual yielding with care to the learning on the part of the young person of what his own footsteps can do for him, this is the proper way. And then you watch the trajectories of the different lives in different directions. So I'm not for the guru thing.
No.
Furthermore, there's another thing about the gurus. This is becoming more and more, to me, a concern with my friends and former students and so on. When one starts an inward meditation under a guru, the problem is the relationship of one's ego to the self. You know that? That's the primary relationship, consciousness to the deeper self. And other relationships, relationships to your wife, to your friends, become intrusions. Do you see what I mean? Whereas, taking the other way, let's say of a marriage, that is an exercise in amplification of ego, opening of ego, the grace of participation in another life, compassion, participation, and all that. That's a religious exercise. That's why it's a sacrament. That's why the two make one. Well, if that's the main relationship in problem in your life, then how are you going to handle this other one at the same time? And that there take place these disintegrations of marriages and families and so forth, with everybody doing the other job. Furthermore, most of the gurus are not married, and they don't know anything about that.
I think of also, we've been talking about the Oriental guru, the Eastern. We also have gurus in the Western. I mean, I think of people in the Human Potential Movement, for example. There are people who essentially have taken on the role of guru.
They themselves are following an Oriental model, I would say.
Okay.
Because it must be really flattering to say, you know, are you enlightened? I am. So, listen, who's talking here? You know, I don't take any guff. One of the things that in the Orient is typical is that any criticism disqualifies you for the guru's instruction. Well, what in heaven's name is that for a Western mind?
Yeah, that's really a toughie.
Yeah. Well, it's simply the transfer of the submission to the father to a father for your adulthood, you know, which means you're not growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, the psychoanalyst does that a good deal. The whole idea of a transfer. What do you transfer to the analyst? You transfer all the parental systems of relationships. So you're still bound. You're still a submissive and dependent person.
When you talk about maturity and adulthood, I think of something Christ said, you must become as a little child to enter the kingdom of heaven. Let's juxtapose that with adulthood and maturity. How do those two come together?
I think what he's talking about is the spontaneity. I think the answer to this comes from Nietzsche in his Zarathustra in the introduction. It's curious to bring Nietzsche in as the one for Christ because typically he's thought to be the Antichrist, you know. He thought so himself a little bit. But these are two great teachers, and great teachers frequently say similar things in different languages. Nietzsche says there are three stages of the spirit. I love this one. The first is that of the camel. The camel gets down on his knees and says, put a load on me. This is the condition, you know, of youth learning. Put a load on me. When the camel is well loaded, he gets to his feet and runs out into the desert. This is the place where he's going to be alone to find himself. And he's transformed into a lion. The second transformation, then, is of the lion. And the task and function and deed of the lion is to kill a dragon. And that dragon's name is Thou Shalt. On every scale of the dragon, a law is written, some dating from 2000 B.C., to some others from yesterday's morning paper. And the dragon is to be killed. And if it's a well-loaded camel, it's a potent lion, and the dragon is killed. You see, they're two different quite things. One, submission, obedience, learning, and now you're a potent lion. And when the dragon is killed, the lion is transformed into a child. And Nietzsche's word is, a wheel rolling out of its own center. Ein aus sich rollendes Rad. A wheel rolling out of its own center. That's what the child represents in this mystical language. The human being has recovered that spontaneity and innocence and thoughtlessness of rules, which is so marvelous in childhood. The little one who comes up and says absolutely embarrassing things to the stranger who's visiting your house, you know, ask them why this, why that, the other parents. That innocence, that courage, that lack of response to the rules. Something of the first two states, no, I wouldn't say that. Wordsworth in that Recollections of Intimations of Immortality through Recollections of Childhood. Shades of the prison house begin to close upon the growing boy. That's the dragon that must be killed, that prison dragon. And I think that's the child. Not the obedient child, but the innocence of childhood and the spontaneity and courage to live its impulse.
Do you have any thoughts on how we as individuals might get in touch with that child that lies within us?
By killing the dragon, thou shalt.
By not choosing to live by other people's rules?
Right.
Yeah.
Respecting them, but not living by them. Respecting them more or less in the way you respect the red and green lights on the highway. There are other rules which seem to be advisable. I mean, if in your own intelligence you see such a rule represents human decency or something like that, but a rule put on you as a rule, thou shalt not, is another show. And I think one can learn to take the courage. It also involves taking responsibility for what you're doing, taking the rap. You know, the buck is right here, I take it. And the suffering and not trying to throw it off if you have made radical mistakes and hurt people and injured people. It can be done.
Joseph, one of the myths that has come out of modern times, and perhaps it reflects our predilection to technology, is the UFO, the unidentified flying object. And I think back to ancient times, and there were UFOs in ancient times. I think of Elijah and the fiery chariot, and I think of the Lady of Fatima and such as that. So there have been perhaps UFOs over centuries. How do you see UFOs? And do you see that as some recurring theme from ancient tradition?
Well, in fact, interpreting your question another way, I've never seen a UFO. I don't expect to see one. But I really don't know what to think of it, because there are certain things I've heard that would indicate that there may be something, you know, that it's not all an illusion. But the interesting thing is the fascination in it. Why the fascination? I'm interested also in these theories that men from outer space have come, or beings from outer space have come and instituted civilizations, and the beginnings of many of our ancient civilizations are from visitors from outer space. I think this is a continuation of something that is at the core of our religious heritage, and I think it's not a very good aspect of the religious heritage, namely that the spiritual power is out from outside. It comes into us. God breathed his breath into dead earth. But the earth isn't dead. The earth is alive. Matter isn't dead. Matter is alive. And matter is not anti-spiritual. Spirit can be understood as the bouquet, you know? And many of the traditions that are counter to the Orthodox tradition in our world, for instance, some of the Arthurian romances are based on the idea that the spirit is not come blown into man from without, but comes forth from the living of the noble heart. It's a quality of man himself. If we get used to the idea that the spirit comes from outside in, that the Savior has come from elsewhere to us and is not a fulfillment of the potentialities of human life itself, then it may be that the fascination that more spirit, more messages, more truth, more wonder would come from outside. So that whether there are UFOs or not, the fascination with the UFO, I regard as a continuation of this notion that the spirit and the giver of the spirit and the power and the glory are out there somehow and not right here within us.
Would that be the same kind of fascination with extraterrestrial intelligence?
Yes, that would be the same thing, that out there it would be somehow greater than here. I received a couple of very amusing phone calls from columnists in women's pages and so forth in New York when the rocket took pictures of Mars, and there were no little twinkly Martians there. I was stunned. Two phone calls saying, you know, this is a terrible disillusionment for people that there are no Martians. What do you think of that? Well, I said, I suppose the whole Santa Claus thing is a disillusion too, but disillusions aren't bad for people after all. I'm not speaking about the possibility of there being UFOs. I'm speaking about this fascination, yes. and I think that it's all a function of this notion that the great power is outside and not within us.
Well, there's a popular writer of books, Eric von Däniken, who has brought out the idea that perhaps human beings were populated from other planets that
yes.
came here to the Earth.
Yes. Well, I think, I don't know what to say about that because I haven't read his book, although everywhere I go people ask me about it, but I just don't have time because there's so much I have to read now.
Sure.
There is, golly, this is a period of marvelous discoveries in archaeology and ethnology and historical backgrounds, and fine things are coming out. I just discovered a small book, which I'm reading right now, by a man named Chester Chard on Northeast Asia in prehistory. It's been a blank, but the Russians and Japanese have done researches there, and those aren't languages that most people in our quarters can read. This man has pulled the whole thing together, and a whole world of history opens up there. Prehistory is particularly exciting because this is the prehistory of Alaska. You know, this from there that the crossing of the Bering land bridge, which was there during the Bering glaciation, took place. And it's reading things like that that's holding me rather than these fantastic things that are coming out like the von Däniken thing. I think we know enough about evolution, and we know enough about the prehistory of man. We don't know everything, but we know enough to know that that kind of interpretation is unnecessary, you know?
You know, one of the things, talking about archaeology and some of the discoveries that are happening, and I think of, you know, Richard the Leakey's discovery in the Old Divide Gorge, and now there's been a later, his wife has mm-hmm. made some new discoveries. So we're talking about human beings having been on the planet for upwards of a million years. Or
4 million years, practically.
Right.
Yeah.
Is it possible, or let's say it's anything's possible, but from your knowledge of mythology and the ancient past, is it possible that other civilizations greater than our own once flourished on the Earth and have totally disappeared?
Well, it would be hard to know where they would have been. The earliest civilizations, as we usually think of the term, that involves monumental architecture and writing and mathematical systems and things of that sort. These all come in as a constellation about 3500 BC in Mesopotamia. And the next great jump is in Egypt itself, which then becomes one of the most majestic civilizations ever, because it was relatively protected, you know, by its situation. There were only Bedouins to eat right and left, and for a continuity of 4,000 years, there it was, right up to the time of the Theodosian Code in the 4th century A.D., when pagan religions were put down, the Egyptian thing was going. China, the Shang Dynasty, 1523 B.C., we sort of know that. And back of China, it is not a high civilization. It's a Neolithic sort of situation with planting and ceramic ware and that kind of thing, but not what we would call a civilization. In India, we know about that. It starts around 2000 B.C., really, with the Indus Valley, and pretty well documented all the way down. Then you jump to the Americas, the Olmec culture, a sudden appearance, about 1100 B.C., and we know about those cultures. Now, where in heaven's name would the other be? One talks about Lemuria and Atlantis.
Yes.
But the whole Lemurian situation is infinitely before the appearance of man on Earth. I mean, you have to have some regard for geology, you know. And as for the Atlantis, I don't know what to say about that. There's no geologist who stands for it, you know. The Atlantis legend, which occurs in the Timaeus and Critias of Plato, has now been more or less, and I think rather convincingly, associated with that wonderful island in the Aegean, Thera, or Santorini as it's called, which it really exploded about 1485 B.C. That was the period when the whole cycle of mother goddess legends, the world of old Europe, of which Maria Gimbutas has written, Gods and Goddesses of Old Europe, 7,000 to 3,500 B.C. That was the period when that closed and the Mycenaean patriarchal system came over, just at the time that the Hebrews were invading Canaan and again bringing in a father god. So there certainly was a turnover in the mythological thinking of mankind about that time, moving from the mother goddess situation to the father god. But we know where those earlier systems flourished, and we don't have to hypothesize a island in the Atlantic. When the Atlantis legend was translated then into modern thinking out of Plato, it still was thought, this was in the early 19th century, that the Mayan period was close in time to the Egyptian, but it wasn't. The Egyptian pyramids date from about 2500 B.C., and the Mayan pyramids from about 500 A.D. There's a little bit different, you know, yeah. In the 3,000 years. So where are these people floating around somewhere in all that time? There's got to be another explanation, I think.
Yeah.
At least it doesn't convince me at all.
What about South America? There seems to be a great deal more interest now in South American early history, early civilizations, and of course there has been for some time, but I'm thinking particularly of Peru and the Andes, and there was a strong spiritual emphasis in those cultures as well. What relevance do you think that those cultures have to us today, if any? Anything we can learn from them?
Well, we have to learn. Well, of course, the people in South America, who are the descendants of the people, the Chavin and the Inca and the other cultures of that area, it's of immediate relevance to them, as our own parental and ancestral backgrounds are to us here in the United States. Likewise, in Mexico, for the Mexican people, where that old culture still exists, in a way, it's tremendously important. But since it was so far out on a limb that, you know, way out in the Americas when the other civilizations were developing in Asia, there was no influence from those areas upon the Eurasian context. And for me, the value consists in that comparative approach that I mentioned earlier in our talk, to see the same motifs in these high civilizations that developed in apparently in almost complete isolation from the ones in the old world, and to see the same forms This gives you a notion of these archetypes of the human spirit that I was talking about earlier. That's the principle of direct, immediate importance of those, I think.
So you would see that more as where they discover a similar pottery fragment in China, say, to something they found in Peru, as synchronistic, as opposed to the cultures blending together, actually?
Actually, Michael, I wouldn't say that. About 10 years ago, the pottery discovered in Ecuador, you know, on the shore of Ecuador, that resembled precisely the early Jomon pottery of Kyushu, the southern island of Japan. I don't think we can get out of that. I think that, that represents a transit across the Pacific. There's been, I mean, it's a technical argument, and the scholars are on both sides. Mm-hmm. But as one scholar said, if this doesn't prove anything, then let's stop talking about pottery, you see. And this was 3000 B.C. Also, it's at that time that the mother goddess image, or at least female figurines, first appear in the Americas, and from there a diffusion has been traced. It's a young woman, Betty Magers, and the work of Ford, where a wonderful reconstruction of the whole diffusion has taken place. But that's just very primitive beginnings. Now, what about the later civilizations and the flowering out of those impulses of civilizations that show the same forms as the old world civilizations? This would seem to indicate a commonality in the human spirit, that those things should... Look, I went through Morley's The Ancient Maya, which is a great book on Mayan civilization, and I identified something like 300 parallels to what we would find in India and Southeast Asia, in the high civilizations there, in the ways of religious belief, astronomical forms, of even spiral stairways and forms of sculpture and modes of building and so forth, with variants, certainly, variations about as great as the difference between American and English architecture, you know. There's variations, but the constants are what really, really, really dumbfound one. And they are the significant clues to the common potentials. Mm-hmm. And there's a question as to whether there were then later influences from Zhou China. I mean, there was one man, Heine Gelden, who made a very strong case for Zhou Chinese and then North Vietnamese influences on the Americas, and then Cambodian. And there's a man at the Museum of Natural History in New York, Ekholm, who has continued that. It's a very convincing case. One way or the other, the influences are striking and worth following out. In the comparisons.
Joseph, I just wanted to, we got into the area of patriarchal and matriarchal there for a moment, yeah. And I just wanted to, I was reflecting on that relative to our own society and how largely America has been, use the term policeman for the world, father of the world, coming in and taking care of those less fortunate, less privileged, etc. And now we have a strong women's movement in the society. And do you see there any changes taking place? Do you see us moving out of a patriarchal model, out of being a father to the world, and perhaps being something else?
Well, in a certain way, we're the slob of the world, too. We've been taken so many times. With respect to this women's moment, I taught for 38 years in Sarah Lawrence College, and so was very close to young women and very seriously concerned with their character and potentialities and so forth and so on. We're at a marvelous moment with respect to the problem of women, and it's a moment that is just as crucial for men as for women. Because the archetypology of just the wife and mother and housewife is gone. And many a man, when he marries, when he thinks of marriage, thinks of that archetype. And he is unwilling to face the, or unable to face, the fact of a female personality. Men have had a bigger range of life courses that have enabled them to develop their potentials. I spoke before, earlier, of the potential and developing one's own life. But women have been condemned, you might say, to one style, one system of interests and concerns. And that's not true anymore. The world has opened up to them. Now there are no models for them. And the immediate model is, of course, the men's world, and many move into that in competition, as it were. But the great thing is the emergence of the possibility of a female personality as the guiding image of the woman's own life. And then her husband has to match that. Do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He's in dialogue now with an unpredictable presence, because the sexes are deeply mysterious to each other, really, and wonderfully so. At college reunions, you know, 10 years after, 20 years after, 30 years after, I would have taught this young woman and recognized certain possibilities. It's easy to tell when the girl comes back, when the woman comes back, whether the husband has been a counterplayer to a personality, which of course helps develop his personality rather than his archetypology of just husband, or the woman who has not been allowed really to flower in her own potential, but has been turned into an archetype. I mean, it's right there in front of you, and you see these young women. And this is the challenge of a marriage. What a beautiful thing, a life together as growing personalities, you know, each helping the other to flower, rather than just moving into a standard archetype. It's a wonderful moment. People can make the decision whether they want to just be cookie mold products, you know, or something quite astonishing and unexpected.
Somehow the latter seems more interesting.
It's more adventurous and a little more dangerous.
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. Requires jumping over the edge a little more.
Yeah.
With no life raft.
No life raft at all.
Right. Let's take a phone call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. I was listening to Mr. Campbell's remarks about gurus before.
About
gurus. I came across two statements by two enlightened masters concerning that, and I'd just like to read and tell them about it. I think they're very enlightening.
Okay.
The first one is by Sri Ramana Maharshi in his book, Talks with Sri Ramana, page 485, and at the bottom it says, "The master is not outside as you seem to imagine. He is within, is in fact the self. Recognize this truth, seek within, and find him there. Then you will have constant communion with him. The message is always there. It is never silent. It can never forsake you, nor can you ever move away from the master." That's one from Sri Ramana.
Yes.
And the other one is from Nisargadatta Maharaj. He says, "The greatest guru is your inner self. Truly he is the supreme teacher. He alone can take you to the goal, and he alone meets you at the end of the road. Confide in him, and you need no other guru."
Good. Well, thank you for sharing that. I'll have Joseph will address that. If you want to hang up now, we can take the answer off the air.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your call. Joseph?
Well, I appreciate those quotations. I know both of these men's work, and that is the great message of the guru. But actually, in practice, normally, the Oriental guru presents you with a path, the stages of the path along the way, himself, you might say, as the enlightened one and the model. And in Oriental cultures, generally, the individual does not have the free open road before him that we have here now. The Svadharma in India is one's caste rules for life. And those are what one follows up to the age of retirement to the forest when one seeks the inner guru. I would say that whenever you read the great teachers, you come to this truth that the guide is within yourself. But by what means are you brought to that truth? Do you see what
That's
I'm trying to say? Yeah. You have to stay with the Oriental thing a long while. I did. I was in it for some 40 years, actually, before I ran up against this realization that there is a put-down, finally, of the idiosyncrasies of the individual. I think the Oriental guru, and this is questionable, I think the Oriental guru thinks that the Lord Master within the each one will guide him the way that they've always been guided.
Yes.
Whereas the idiosyncrasies of the phenomenal individual are transcended, I would think that in the West they can be developed and appreciated in a way that's not of the Orient. I have absolutely nothing against the words that have come over here, and they're beautiful words, and I'm grateful to have heard them again.
Yes.
And I thank the gentleman who read those.
What about the incarnation, not just the guru, but the God incarnation, the person recognized by, in some cases, millions and millions of people as physically an incarnation of God?
It's a very mysterious business, and I've been in this all my life, and I don't understand it. One to whom I devoted a good deal of my own time, I helped Swami Nikhilananda do the translation of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. I worked on that for about 4 years. And was soaking in the Ramakrishna tradition. And when I went to India with Nikhilananda, I was visiting the monasteries and the monks and listening to their teachings and lectures and so forth and so on. What is the thing that is recognized that makes this man an incarnation? Since the Brahman is within us all, anyone who realizes the Brahman within himself would be a manifestation of Brahman. What is the incarnation motif? It's a kind of mythological concept that really, it seems to me, recognizes this man as one who very early achieved the realization. Of course, there's a reincarnation idea behind it all, too, that in earlier lifetimes he prepared himself and rendered himself eligible for that incarnation. All I have to say is this I do not understand.
The answer. Let's take another phone call. Hello, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Thank you. I wondered if Mr. Campbell might care to comment or reflect on an image that seemed to me to be associated with a lot of the things that he has related with tonight and that is mentioned in one of his books and that he hasn't really discussed, and that is the moon. And I just couldn't help but thinking that relevant to what he was saying, it ties in with the matriarchies and the patriarchies as different modes of being and the commonality of the spirit today and the search of some people for things exterior rather than within. Or however he might wish to comment today on the effect of landing on the moon and the Mars and the various planets outside of the Earth has in the mythic realm.
Okay, good. Thank you for your call.
Well, I have said that I think it's the most interesting thing that's happened in the 20th century. And in terms of mythology, it's extremely interesting. Because the planets and their lights were, and have been for millenniums, thought to be manifestations of a higher light, a higher realm, another realm. And then we land on the moon, and it's of our own Earth. You know, with Galileo, the ballistic principle was used to interpret the movement of the planets and the moons and so forth. So the laws of Earth are the laws of these planets, and they do not represent a counterplayer to Earth. What I said before, the spirit coming out of matter rather than being breathed into it is somehow here. The whole miracle of that we has been read as a supernatural miracle is a natural one. Whatever the marvel of the sun may be that projects this light that illuminates the moon, and whatever the nature of the earth may be, which is the same nature as that of the moon, it's now all a continuity. So the spiritual principle is not out there somewhere of a different order, but this moon principle is of the earth. In
yeah.
a certain way. And I remember those wonderful moments of the moon flight. I was just glued to the television set for every single one of them. I thought they were just marvelous, marvelous things. I thought the put-down that they got from the press and from some of our universities, I remember a poster that was I saw up in Cambridge when I was up there at one time with one of our wonderful astronauts on the moon in this moon suit, and underneath it said, "So what?" You know, well, it's not a so what at all. It is a wonderful technological achievement, but it's also a demonstration of this mythological principle that no matter how far we will go into space, it will be principles within ourselves. But there's an aspect even more marvelous than that. When before the first moon landing, those who circled the moon before that were on their way back to the Earth. Ground control asked, "Who's navigating now?" And the answer that came was Newton. And this broke my mind. Out of Newton's laws, they knew how to circle the moon. No one had ever been there before. They knew just how much energy to expel to bring them down to a battleship waiting in the Pacific Ocean. No one knew how deep the dust was going to be on the moon when Armstrong's foot came down. But they knew exactly what the laws of space were up there. So the laws of space are the laws of our mind. This is a point that Kant brings out here, and he asks in his Introduction to Metaphysics, how is it that we can predict with apodictic certainty the laws of a space elsewhere from that space in which we're sitting, you know, over there? How is it that it stays that way? How is it that it stayed that way up there? And those are the laws that will work and are working for Mars, Jupiter, or wherever the hell they want to send these things.
Yeah.
This is the marvel I see. It's a great thing. It's all within ourselves. The whole mystery of space is known to us, and we don't know it.
I'm thinking of just the drive that has been apparent in a few human beings in different societies and different cultures all through recorded history, of exploring another frontier, of exploring the mystery, the unknown. And at the same time, there are examples of cultures where apparently they've remained fixed in a static state. I mean, we find Aboriginal cultures in Australia that have been there for centuries, and no one ever apparently moved out beyond a certain place in the forest kind of thing. What is the difference, and what is that drive?
God knows. That marvelous discovery of the Tassadai people in the Philippines a couple of years ago, you know, Stone Age people today in the Philippines, and people only a few miles away that were of a far more developed thing. There's a beautiful book on this subject by John Nance, N-A-N-C-E, called The Gentle Tassadai. It's lovely. What that shows is that primitive man was no brute. He was a gentle, sweet, delicate, charming child, you know? These people who know nothing but the jungle and are so at home there with love for it, when they are led out of the jungle, become frightened and go back. In Turnbull's book on the pygmies of the Congo, you have exactly the same thing. He took one of them in his car up on for a little expedition out of the deep jungle where he could look over the plains. And the man had no concept of how to read distance. He thought that a herd of buffalo down there were crickets. They were so small.
Huh.
This fear of something new is so contrary to the exploration urge that has been characteristic of the European world particularly. I think more than any other, the European have done it. And when you read what the explorers, when you know what the explorers endured in those early voyages of the ocean, it's no one today would dare it, it seems to me.
Yeah.
And that they had whole crews on those boats that were willing to do that. Whereas now, you know, if they have to carry a load over a certain number of pounds, they go on strike. these things are fantastic. Perhaps we're getting back to the old jungle thing of not wanting to try something new.
Times. Let's take another phone call. Our phone number here is 864-2051. We're talking with Joseph Campbell. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, this is the one that I was waiting for. I'm reading Ortega's What is Philosophy, and he discusses how a man discovers his inner self. Whether your guest is familiar with Ortega's writings, I don't know. But the point that Ortega makes is that ancient man was so beset by external problems, he had no time to think of internal problems. And I wonder if you could comment on that.
Okay, thank you.
Well, Ortega happens to be one of my great favorites, but I would not be inclined to agree with that particular remark, because I think that ancient man was considerably concerned with internal problems, and I think that he solved them often in better ways than we're solving them right now. It was not that he was not concerned with them. There are two kinds of primitive man, I mean, in this context. One, the people who are living in rather arid and unproductive lands, whose whole lives are given to the struggle for sheer existence. And in those cultures, you find only fragmentary mythological structures. But when you come to people like the Northwest Coast Indians here, or the Polynesians, or the Pueblo people in our southwest, or the Iroquois and Algonquins of the northeast forests, these mythologies are rich and developed and highly sophisticated mythologies. And some of them go a little further in the understanding of man than our normal positivist philosophers do. I would just like to call attention to that lovely book that Neihardt published, Black Elk Speaks, and read the words of that old medicine man. His vision came to him when he was a youngster as in a shamanistic crisis, and it included a statement that matches one of the most sophisticated statements in 12th century philosophy. He said, in my vision, I saw myself on the central mountain of the world, Mount Harmon, or something like this, in South Dakota. But he said, the central mountain of the world is everywhere. He there distinguished between the cult image, you see, of Mount Harmon, and the reference of the cult image. And this corresponds to a word that comes to us from the book of the 24 philosophers, a Hermetic text of the 12th century, or at least a Greek text that was translated into Latin in the 12th century. God is an intelligible sphere whose circumference is nowhere and center everywhere. It's the same thing.
Uh-huh.
This is not only an inward knowledge, it's a metaphysical realization. And I find things like that, sayings like that, all over the place when I'm reading the words that have been taken from these non-literate sages. I'm inclined to think that they were very much concerned with the inner man. But as for Ortega y Gasset, there are great, great things that that man has written, and I would recommend as a major introduction to his way of thinking that wonderful early book of his, Meditations on Don Quixote. That's where he points out that in the period of Galileo, a crisis occurred. Formerly, the hero in the Arthurian romances, for instance, moved into a landscape that was ready to receive his psyche. That is to say, what he was ready to experience presented itself to him, so that the landscape was, as it were, a projection of his own psychological problems, potentialities, and realizations. Whereas with Galileo, the landscape suddenly becomes hard, and Don Quixote goes out, and instead of the landscape being what he expected, it turns out to be windmills. You know, that story. Right. And this is then the problem of the adventurous spirit of man against the hard wall, you know, of the scientifically documented world. And where now is the adventure? You read that, and it's a sophisticated, beautiful job. Of course, that is a system of inward problems that the primitive man knows nothing about. This one of facing such a world as we know.
Yes.
And, with that, perhaps that might be the answer to what Ortega y Gasset was talking about, and my controversion of his statement might be out of place.
That's a profound question you just asked, too. Where now is the adventure?
Yeah, where is the adventure?
Both microcosmically and macrocosmically.
Right, yeah.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, is this me?
Yes, it's you.
Yeah, I've been so busy listening, I almost forgot my question. Because that was about earlier things. I have a couple here, so if you can, I'll just say them and then answer which one he wants. Has the nuclear family, is that considered, according to all Campbell's reading, a man's invention, or is that, like, does he consider it natural and always has existed.
The nuclear family,
yeah,
the family unit.
I'm just going to read all the questions, if you like.
Well, just give us a second one, and then hold, because we have other callers.
Joseph used to say that the moon had beings on it that fed on us, and I assume these are like elemental beings. Has Campbell ever written anything on that kind of thing?
Okay, fine. We'll deal with both of those. Thank you.
Well, I never deal with elemental beings because I don't know anything about them.
Okay.
I'm very much interested in the spirit and mythology and religion and all of that. But I have a training in science, and perhaps that limits my field of concern and also belief. And
yes.
Civilizations that don't have any leave evidence behind them, I don't know anything about them.
Right. What about the nuclear family?
Well, the nuclear family is the family of our world. When you go, for instance, to Polynesian societies, where everybody is the parents of every child, and at least in their spiritual relationship to the child, the children are the children of the tribe almost, and there's a great deal of lending out of children and adoption of children. The nuclear family position is dissolved. Among the Tassadai, there's man, wife, and their children. That would be the nuclear family motif there. But what do you do, for instance, with Islam when a husband can legally have four wives, you know, and all of this? I think there are so many possibilities for human sexual counterplay that we can't.
But what about the idea that, say, well, our family unit is crumbling, we're going to go to the dogs? What about that?
Well, our culture has been based on the family unit, you see. And when the family unit dissolves, the problem of educating the children becomes a crucial one. That's what's happening right now in the schools. The schools have to take over the civilization of the children, which the parents have not been rendering because there weren't any parents, or only a fraction of the normal parenthood. A mother can't play the roles really successfully and easily of father and mother. This builds up bad psychological situations in the child. I've seen it. The resentment of the child to the mother, because the mother has played the other role as well, has had to. Actual expressions of hatred for the mother on the part of perfectly decent young women that just astound me. This is the disintegration of the family, of the nuclear family, and our culture hasn't solved the next step yet.
Right.
I would say.
Let's take another phone call. Hello there. You're on the air. Hello. You're on the air. Nope. Guess we lost him. Hello, you're on the air. Hello? Hello, you're on the air.
We've lost our public.
Yes, we're not making it here with the telephones. We apologize for those callers that we may have lost there. We're talking with Joseph Campbell. We were children, Joseph, when I was a child anyway, and other friends of mine who I've talked to about their childhood, fairy tales was a big thing. And somehow when we move into adulthood and maturity and all of that, we lose the fairy tale. What happens?
I think we lose the sense of wonder. Shades of the prison house begin to close upon the growing boy, says Wordsworth, you remember? And he becomes a stuffy person. My wife, Jean Erdman, has a theater in New York now, and among the presentations are some puppet plays. She has a puppet theater for children. And of course, these are full of fantasy, and they're lovely, lovely things. And the parents bring the children, and usually the mother, and the delight of the children in the event often gives the parent the delight too. They return to the childhood, you know, mm-hmm. and get into the spirit of the magic of the fairy tale. The fairy tale is talking to us about the wonder of our own psyches again. They carry the archetypes that are in the old myths, mm-hmm. and it's the sort of inability to experience the myths of our own religion. Our religions have been interpreted to us in historical terms, you know. The Jews did go through the Red Sea, and Moses did climb the mountain, and he got the law, and he came down, and he broke the tablets, and he went up and got a second edition and came down again. Okay. All it's interpreted that way. Not the mystery side of it, not the event as symbolic of quests and all in the individual. And so when the fairy tale comes along and doesn't have any actuality, it doesn't pretend ever to have happened, but is simply of the mystery kind, we have been trained away from receiving the message.
Yeah, it's almost like we use it, that's a fairy tale.
It's a fairy
tale. It's like it's not real.
Yeah. There are people who like true stories, you know, and so people write true stories that aren't true at all, and then people enjoy reading them, whereas if they thought they weren't true, they would be indifferent to them. Well, I think it's the loss of the ability to take seriously the images of the imagination and the wish always for the newspaper truth, you know, that weans people away from the sense of magic of their own lives and of these tales.
Yeah, how can we get back in touch with that magic?
Jake, bring the kids to the show, or read your fairy tales to the children, or read fairy tales after you've read, let's say, a little bit of Jung, and just see how the whole thing is there, how they are realizations of dreams, how the motifs are playing. Bultmann, you know, the great theologian of the just the last generation, speaking about demythologizing religion, my thought is it should be re-mythologized, not reading it as fact. When we read the legends of the Buddhas, you know, Avalokiteshvara or Amida or these, we don't read of those as though they were historical characters, because they weren't, and they never have been given as historical characters. We should look at some of our own mythological material that way and get the truth from them, and then turn to the little fairy tales, and you'll see that it's there too.
Yeah.
I'm very much for fairy tale as the introduction to high symbolic systems. In fact, I did a commentary on Grimm's fairy tales that was published by Pantheon Books, and there I bring this out, that the backgrounds of the fairy tale and are those of the myths as well.
What is the relevance of ritual in our life?
A ritual is the enactment of a myth. And by participating in the ritual, you're participating in the myth. And since the myth is a projection of the depth wisdom of the psyche, by participating in the ritual, participating in the myth, you are being, as it were, put in accord with that wisdom, which is the wisdom that is inherent within you anyhow. Your consciousness is being reminded of the wisdom of your own life. I think ritual is terribly important.
Yeah. So I think of... I've been involved in some discussions recently with people of the Catholic faith talking about their unhappiness with the change in the ritual, that no longer the Latin Mass and that kind of thing, and seemingly very, very upset about that, because somehow the mystery has gone, the mystery is no longer there.
It's been flattened out, I would say, but... I was brought up a Catholic, but I haven't been to Mass for 50 years. I did go to the Mass of my mother's funeral and of a niece's wedding, and, well, all I could say was that I had lost contact. For me, one of the marvelous things about the Roman Catholic Mass in Latin was that no matter where you went, you were at home in the Catholic Mass. I remember as a youngster being in Switzerland, going to Mass there, or in France, or in Germany, just as at home as I would have been in my own parish church. And now with it translated into the local language, that Catholicity, that
yes.
universality has been taken away. Furthermore, the thing is rather flat. The English isn't particularly elegant into which
yes.
it has been translated, and the Latin was elegant.
Yes, right.
And also the address of the priest now turned around so that he faces the congregation rather than facing the mystery also changes the whole mood. It turns it into a kind of, well, one could say a Protestant social rather than a Gothic mystical performance.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that it's an inferior performance. I'm saying it's not
yes.
the same thing at all. And if you are brought up to appreciate the mysterious, which is what the world is, a mystery, then I think you suffer a loss. Although I've talked about this with priests, and they've just told me I don't know what I'm talking about because I haven't experienced the modern mass
mm-hmm.
as it is rendered.
Yeah.
So it's something I shouldn't talk about.
Let's take another phone call, see if we've got the technical trip together here. Hello, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, I can't hear you.
Okay, well, go ahead and ask your question.
Okay, I'm afraid you may have, or Mr. Campbell, over the past few minutes, may have answered my question. I was wanting to ask, and it's a little hard to put this into words, but I was wanting to ask about how we get a handle on myth today. What is myth in the modern world? Is the mythic dimension evolving or mutating, or myth still being produced, or is it is there something about our technological, materialistic, factual-oriented reality that is antithetical to myth and it's going to sort of dissolve?
Okay, thank you.
All of the old mythological systems grew up within the bounded horizon, and they were addressed to people who had essentially the same order of experiences, so that a signal would be understood in the same way and be responded to in similar ways by everybody involved in the culture. Now, in our world, those horizons are all smashed. I mean, this is a main point in my thinking about the contemporary world. One of the main decisions to make with respect to your own mythology is to what society do you belong? Because one of the functions of myth is the integration of a social system. Social system is blown. And what is our social group? The challenge of the day is that our social group is all of mankind, but there aren't many people who can swallow that. It's a big load. And what I'm seeing all over the place are retreats into group alignments. And we know the words. I hope no one will take offense at my naming of some of these. But the Aryan supremacy was one. And then the chosen people thing, the prodigious strengthening of the Israel consciousness today. Then the Black Power movement. Then different caste movements, you might say. This order, the industrialists, the great business people, they have a common cause, and that's what they're fighting for. They have the mythology of industry. And then the union movement, the labor movements, all these, against other people. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a closing in. This is a very natural response, particularly with the national order smashed in a certain way, and with a great multiplicity of human types in any given place. We've tried to hold our culture together rationally. Do you see, it's essentially a secular society, not a mythologically grounded society. We've allowed people to find their own myth, their own religion, and so forth. That's the essential of this country. And nevertheless, what is the sociological side of this new thing? I don't see a single mythology coming out at all. The dominant power in our present world is politics and economics. This has nothing to do with mythology. The culture form does not really teach a mythological experience, so that you don't find those psychological grounds given you in the culture. The old days, when you would enter a town, as one can today in a place like Chartres, the highest building is the cathedral. It's a spiritual, grounded culture that was, based on the whole myth of fall, redemption, salvation, and the church as the vehicle of grace.
I was just thinking of the highest building in San Francisco, like the Bank of America
That's
World Headquarters or the Transamerica Pyramid.
Exactly the point I'm coming to. And that tells you what's running the place. It's business buildings and dwelling buildings, so that it's politics and economics. There's no doubt about it. And the mythology, then, is left to the individual to find. And we need it. Everybody needs it. And each is on his own quest right now. Now, whether later on something else will come of it, I mean, it's much too early to predict anything like that. But I can think of an earlier moment when agriculture came in, you know, and the old hunting and gathering, small hunting and gathering societies were archaic, and a whole new world, a whole new mythology, plowing the earth and all of this. It took hundreds of years before this congealed into a viable and life-supporting and city-supporting mythology. So perhaps we are in a transitional state. But I'm told that Adam said to Eve when they were expelled from the garden, this is a transitional moment. And perhaps the essence of progressing life is exactly that, but we're certainly in it. I think of us as in a kind of free fall into the future without any guides for our spirits, and the individual has to find it in the way of his own darkest place where there is no way or path that I mentioned a little while earlier. I don't see anything coming in the way of a common mythology. I don't even know whether a culture can survive without a mythology. It's a moment of questions and mystery, I think.
Yeah. Just to carry another step further in the pursuit of that area, do you see this coming together in these retreats into little conclaves, protecting our own, whether it be industry or technology or this cult or that tradition or that religion, whatever, as kind of a last-ditch effort to avoid the coming together of everyone? I mean, certainly we were talking about the space program earlier, and certainly the idea of seeing that planet out there hanging in space, everyone got the idea that we are all here together, finally, and that was an experiential moment for the whole planet. Do you see these conclaves as sort of a last-ditch fight to hold on to their own?
I'm something of an optimist, and I have my hopes. I hope they are last-ditch fights. And when I think of some common thing that's coming up now, I think the ecological problem may be the common thing. When everybody realizes we're knocking our environment out, we got to get together on that, then our relationship to the Earth, we'll all have the same problem. Do you see what I mean?
Yes,
that's
sure.
What that is the
right.
Kind of the background of a kind of base
out of the,
for
out of
a mythology.
The problem that affects everyone,
yeah.
We can come to unity.
And to realize then that there's a mutual concern and compassion for other people instead of fighting for your little bit, because you're ruining the planet.
Yes.
That may be something that would might begin to work.
Just if we can get through that political...
Really the political mess is such a disgusting and disheartening thing.
Yeah. Because there we have little France exploding its nuclear bombs, and we have little China, big China over here exploding its nuclear, little cloud floats over the whole planet.
And who cares in China, you know?
Right.
It went over the neighborhood. I don't know, it's a bad show.
Maybe there's hope for the future yet. Let's take another phone call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Okay, I cannot hear you either.
You can hear us on the radio, right?
Yeah, it's quite an echo.
Yeah.
Ask
your question. Go ahead.
Okay, my question is a little esoteric, and it concerns Mendeleev and his postulation and discovery of the periodic table of elements. And in my chemistry classes, I've heard that there's a mythological background for his thesis. And I wonder if Mr. Campbell knows about that.
This is news to me. Interesting news, and I'd like to know more about it. I just don't know anything about this.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
You're welcome. Hello, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I can't hear you. My two questions are, one, Dr. Campbell said that he mentioned the mystery of male and female to each other earlier. And I want to know if he would amplify that even beyond the cultural and conventional social roles. The second question is that he talked about Black Elk. Black Elk got his power from a psychodramatic enacting of his personal vision. And is this use of improvisatory ritual, improvising one's ritual based on one's personal vision, common in any other cultures?
Okay, thank you. Right.
Bye.
I'm not quite sure that I understood that last. Did you?
He was talking about Black Elk.
Yes, Black Elk.
Reenacting his ritual personally.
Yes.
In a psychodramatic fashion.
Oh.
And that's where his power came from. Is that something that you find in
Black
other cultures?
Black Elk's vision came from his own psychological crisis. When he came out of it, he had communicated to his community, because he read it not as simply a personal message, but a message for his people. And he rendered it in the form of ritual performances. This, I think, is actually probably the basic source of ritual everywhere. The vision of some seer becomes the source of an enactment, which then agitates the inward resonances, you know, of everyone participating, and so there is a general experience then of the implications of the forms of the ritual itself. One does find this in other cultures. Where else do rituals come from? Do you see? They're not spontaneous manifestations just of the group, mostly. That was an old romantic theory, that the group rendered it. It usually comes from specific visionaries. The role of the shaman and the shamanic vision and its counterpart, the visions of saints and sages, in the rendering of ritual lore, I think it's been quite considerable. At least this is my view of the matter.
So again, it reinforces that idea we were talking about earlier of taking your own power, taking hold of your own power and expressing it.
Yes. Well, there are two kinds, I suppose, of personal experience of this order. One, the experience that's of no use to anybody but yourself. You know, it has to do with your own personal fix. But the other is the one where your fix is the same as everyone else's in a certain way, only you're the one that got to the inside of it, and then what you express just catches right on. It's an extraordinary thing the way certain of the great religious traditions have caught on, the way Paul's vision of Jesus as the mystery cult savior, you know, following just the language, really, of the Greek mystery cults, translating it to Jesus, or translating Jesus into that context, the tree of the fall and the tree of the redemption as two counterplayers, and Christ as the fruit of the tree of eternal life, the way that caught on, just like wildfire. And still more dramatic, of course, was the message of Islam, the way within 100 years that thing had spread from Mecca. The Muslims were right up into France, through Spain, they entered Spain in 711, and they're on the borders of India, having knocked down most of the Byzantine Empire and all of the Persian. It's fantastic. And rituals come right out of that. The whole ritual life of Islam comes out of the words of Muhammad, as translated. So that seems to me to be the main source.
Going back to the caller's other question about, could you amplify on the, what we were talking about, the mystery of the male to the female and the mystery of the female to the male beyond the social, cultural model, any other amplification you can give to that one?
That's for poetry, and it's a beautiful thought, but I don't feel competent right off the cuff to address myself to anything really so profoundly wonderful. One experiences it in one's life and in various ways. And I think, personally, it runs through the whole of life, this counterplay. Even people who react against it or who think themselves as not in touch with it, I think are moved by it very, very deeply and profoundly and in mysterious ways. And as I told you earlier, I just celebrated my 40th anniversary yesterday. I think I've experienced this wonder in a beautiful way for a long time. And others who have managed to stick it out, you might say, will know what I'm talking about.
We are talking with Joseph Campbell, world-renowned mythologist for sure. We have only a few minutes left, and perhaps in these final moments, Joseph, we could... I'd like to ask you, if you know, you're traveling around a lot, you're seeing a lot of people, talking to a lot of people, particularly young people. What do you see happening? What kind of a vision do you have of what's going on outside of what we read in the newspapers and see on television?
Well, I think America is a very different thing from what we see in the newspapers and see on television. I find beautiful people everywhere. People seriously concerned with these things. We hear and read of America as materialistic, you know, and gadget conscious and all of that. That's an outside aspect of it all. I've been in practically every part of this country now within the past, since I retired from teaching the past 5 years, and everywhere it's the same, and it's a different people from the people you meet in Europe. There's a quality in this country that is of this country, and it has to do with a rather relaxed relationship to other human beings, and a freedom in thinking about new thoughts. We don't have, it's an old story, and I feel that I'm saying an old hackneyed thing. We don't have great heavy traditions behind us. And there's a big value here, particularly in a world where the traditions are collapsing. People are initiating their own lives in a certain way. I find a wonderful quality of compassion for suffering people everywhere, and it often redounds to our own disadvantage. In fact, it has in a conspicuous way. We don't seem to mind that. We go on. The young people, well, they're very different in one part of the country from another. They're different here from the way they are in the New York area, for example. They're wonderful in both areas, but they're very, very different. Here I see much less tension, much more relaxed relationships to things, less pomposity. The New York people think they're deep, you know, and I, New York,
and we know we're deep here.
Well, I'm not speaking about you being deep or not deep, but you don't think you are, you know what I mean? Also, New York's a great place to work. There's battleground there. I mean, everybody's in competition. It's a struggle place, and there people are consequently unwilling to let themselves go quite as here, lest somebody challenge and knock them down. I mean, this is the feeling I'm having. I spent the past year. I haven't been here for a year. You know, I've been working on this book of mine in the city because I have a collaborator there doing the pictures and that kind of thing. And coming back here just about a week ago, oh, it was so refreshing. The quality of the kids in the colleges that I visited down in Santa Barbara and in Long Beach, and up here now, it's something that just delights me. And it seems to be more particularly American somehow than what we get in New York. This isn't to put down New York, which I greatly appreciate. With respect to the religious life, I have surprises. I was down in Alabama and only a couple of weeks ago, and there I found the real radicals were the Methodists. They, you know what I mean? The Four Square Gospel and Baptism was, the Baptists were the basic people there. And I didn't think there was that kind of thing in the world anymore. But it's very strong. So one can't say something that goes for all of America. It's one section, another section. I've been used mostly to urban and university people. But when I go out, then I find another thing. And the thing that strikes me there is the lovely quality of it all. I mean, the religion there is working in the way of a humanizing function, which I had forgotten lay in its possibilities.
If you had one thing to let our listeners know, there was one thing that you could let them know of that might be of value to them in their lives, what would it be?
Well, it would be that word that we had a little earlier of conquering the thou shalt as the lion, and becoming the spontaneous child, courageous of your own initiative, and not too overawed by authorities. The older you get, the more you realize that the authorities are a bunch of troubled youngsters. Also, don't be afraid of growing old. This is something that has come over me in the past 4 years. The realization of the wonder of age, that youth is always living with an eye to a future and achievement and moving into something, so that the present moment is always auxiliary to something to come. Whereas in age, there's nothing to come. I mean, you're there, kid, and suddenly life becomes more glowing and resonant and wonderful as is. You're moving through a luminous and joyous world all the time. And people, the people you lived for in the beginning, are all gone. Life is a bubble. I mean, the Buddhist saying, you know, like a cloud, like a passing wind. So it all is. And the what seems so hard and threatening before you, that's a bubble too. And with all that, the new bubbles have a kind of self-being of their own that's very rewarding. I have the feeling that this is the life that I was being trained for throughout the whole series of years.
Joseph, as always, in the present moment, it's joyous. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Michael.